maybe while people are sort of writing their questions, can I ask you, Kev, what did you most enjoy about Daniel so far?
Yeah, thank you. I've really enjoyed the courage of Daniel and his friends. I'm naturally a total conformist. To stand out from the crowd, scares me a lot. I think what I've loved and appreciated this time, are we on, Steve? Is this, you're happy? Yeah. How you get to that place of courage from kind of the worldview stuff. So it's asserted that God rules. We get that again and again through the visions. You know, he's the only one who knows the future. But that's demonstrated in history, in Daniel 1-6, and then in the history that follows the book of Daniel, you can see that he rules. And then it's from that place of those convictions and convinced that he really is in charge of history that Daniel and his friends are able to be bold. So I'm inspired to be more like them in all of that.
That's great. Thank you. Here's a question. Why have these two halves of narrative and prophecy? Why not just one or the other?
Yeah. Okay, so kind of linked to what I just said, and it's interesting that this chapter is the hinge. This chapter is the hinge in that it's written in Aramaic, like chapter 2-7, structurally goes with chapter 2-7, but it's the beginning of the vision section. You know, clearly it's in the same genre as the stuff that follows. I think we've been given this chapter in this way so that we tie the two books together. I think we'd be tempted to treat them as two separate books otherwise, and I think that would be a massive shame because we'd miss things like what I was saying about the fact that all of the details in chapter 7 have already been played out. So God's people are going to reign. Yeah, right. Well, look at Daniel. Look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were brought to positions where they reigned in the kingdom. For example, this is really going to be a global reach. All peoples, nations, languages were sent these proclamations, remember? So I think we're able to be more convinced about the prophecy because we've seen it played out in history already. Mm.
That's really helpful. And then just also still on how Daniel writes his book, can you say again about the significance of the use of the two languages in Daniel?
Yeah, so it seems to be something about the fact that Aramaic was the kind of the English of its day. It's what people from all over the world would speak when they got together. So that's got a global reach. And I think quite rightly, as we've gone through these chapters, we've tried to kind of proclaim to the world, you know, in chapter 7, you know, this is where history's headed. Are you going to be with the people of God or against them? So there's a reach out and tell the world and call the world into the kingdom from this. Going back into Hebrew in chapter 8 to the end, I think is going to say this is more relevant to the people of God. We'll see that it particularly next week, things like the persecution the people of God will experience. So maybe it makes sense we've gone back to Hebrew for that.
That's helpful, thank you. Someone says, just thank you very much for the Genesis allusions. They hadn't spotted that, so thank you, Kev. Why does Daniel end with the Roman Empire? Or what parts are supposed to be prophesying events still in the future to us?
Yeah, so I think it's a both and with this. So because of the first beast being this eagle-feathered individual, we had an eagle-feathered individual in Nebuchadnezzar who was also the first of the people mentioned in the vision of kingdoms in chapter 2. So it seems pretty clear that Nebuchadnezzar is the first beast there. So that pegs things down to world history. And then you just go through from there. The Medes and Persians, Greeks are mentioned in the next chapter. So the issue is whether the fourth kingdom is Greece or Rome. There's a bit of debate about that. Partly because there's a little horn in chapter 8 that seems to definitely be Greece. Some people want to say, well, that's the little horn in chapter 7 as well. It doesn't have to be. There could be two little horns, which would be what you have to say if you think that the fourth kingdom is Rome, which kind of fits with the fact that then Jesus and his kingdom come after Rome. That also fits with the vision of chapter 2. So there's something there in the years following Daniel. But because of what I said about it seems to be a Genesis to end of time timeline in chapter 7. We're also working with stuff that goes on all the way through history. Jesus, in his apocalyptic chapter of his own, Matthew 24, talks about the rise and fall of nations, the persecution of Christians that will come in the era of the gospel. So we can expect all of that there. Same in Revelation 13, where the beast is all of these characters meshed together in the era before judgment. So it's hard then. You can expect, there are kingdoms that are particularly beastly, seem to be humanized. The Roman Empire seemed to some extent to be humanized by Christianity. And then you've got emperors that are particularly vicious towards Christians. So you can see types all the way through history, I'm afraid, of what's described here.
Okay, thanks. Sometimes I struggle to apply Daniel to myself throughout the week. Can you share some of the ways you've been applying Daniel to yourself, how it's changed your mind, hard actions? And I guess we don't live in a place like North Korea or experience that sort of tyranny.
No, that's right. I mean, so go back to what I said before, really. Let's start with the worldview stuff. You know, God rules. Be convinced as you see that described through predictions fulfilled and through history played out in the book of Daniel. And then I think it's right to say Daniel and his mates are role models of when we have to say yes and when we have to say no. And it can get quite beastly quite quick, can't it? You know, the cultural waves that we are tempted to get swept up in. Everyone has to agree with this. You know, we all believe this now. And to you know, when I'm up at the rugby club, to you know, stand out as different, say actually we, you know, we're Christians, we don't believe in that. You know, it feels risky even at the relational level, and that's where it challenges me. Am I prepared to just take a risk, trust that he rules, leave the consequences with him? It's really challenged me.
Yeah. Thank you. How as Christians should we think about the fiery furnace or the lion's den? Presumably not assuming God will save us from circumstances like that.
Yeah, that's right. I'm afraid that's what chapter 7 is teeing us up for, the fact that God doesn't always or usually even rescue from those kind of experiences. I mean, history is littered with wonderful rescue stories of Christians in situations of danger being miraculously rescued by the Lord. But there's also a ton of stories of Christians being pummeled as well. And I think, remember the cross, you know, kind of we give thanks, I suppose, that Jesus wasn't rescued from his fiery furnace. That's our only hope. And we need to remember that the way of the cross is actually the way of the Christians as well as the way of the Christ. And as God worked through his way of the cross, we can trust that he's at work in ours. I say that from a position of obvious quite a lot of comfort compared to those Christians tonight in North Korea.
Kev, do you have any tips for how we can read prophecy in the Bible, like this chapter, when we're just not sure about how it's technically fulfilled, when we find that tricky?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I think basically just hold your nerve and keep using your basic Bible tool, which is your context tool. Quite a lot of what we've said there comes from just reading 1 to 6 and the rest of the book properly. So keep using your context tool first before reading commentaries about this is whoever from, you know, the 10th century. Read the chapters around it, and that will help.
Mm-hmm. Great. You said something about this already, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It sounds like you're saying Daniel is about God's sovereignty. So how are we to apply individual chapters? Well, looking more at God, being more like Daniel, not being like those kings.
Yeah. very good. Looking more at God would go right through the book. Being like Daniel, where we get some application from him and his mates, I'd say that as well. So I don't think that's an either or. I think the worldview shapes but the behaviors in the book of Daniel. And not being like those kings, yeah. If you happen to rise to a position of global government, then don't be like those dudes.
Great. There's quite a lot on the different kingdoms and rules. I think we've covered all that. Let's do this one as a final one. There are lots of other places in the Bible that tell us that God rules. What do you think is the unique aspect of the book of Daniel?
Yeah, well, I think it's its place in the Bible timeline. So it's at the end of the Old Testament story. We're moving into this period now where they think they're coming back to Israel. They do start to come back to the land by the end of Daniel's time. And it's just a massive expectation manager and saying, you might be back in Israel, but guys, the long haul here, there's going to be a long haul of chaos seeming, big anti-God governments ruling the world, ruling you. You have bed in for the long haul and trust him.